Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Well, this is it. This is Election Day. We've been doing a countdown. It's been, you know, 70 days to the election, 60 days to the election. And it is right here. And America's already feeling great again. We're having a new unscalable wall built at the White House. They've boarded up all of Washington, D.C. So things are going well, I guess. So we are joined on the line by Kevin Williamson of National Review and of many things. And well, first of all, welcome to the podcast on what's going to be a pretty wild and crazy day, I'm thinking.
Yeah, I think, you know, as I was saying before, I think I'm kind of need to take a nap at some point. I remember the 2016 election, and I was watching Fox News, and it's the only time I ever watched stuff like that, and watching the states come in. And right around the time it looked like Pennsylvania was going to go for Trump, I switched it over to MSNBC. Just because I enjoyed the kind of Al Qaeda hostage video quality of the expressions on everyone's face right then. And I was obviously not very happy about seeing Donald Trump elected president of the United States of America. But I understand that kind of, you know, partisan animal spirit, at least on election night, because it was kind of fun to watch Hillary Clinton lose.
Well, there's going to be a lot of schadenfreude. And by the way, you mentioned that I probably will be on MSNBC at least briefly tonight. And we're also doing a live stream for The Bulwark. And it occurred to me that that means there'll be a record of my face when things happen. You know, last time I'm sitting, you know, doing the doom scrolling thing and looking at that damn New York Times needle. But they're bringing back the freaking needle. Kevin, does anybody in the world want the needle back? I mean, anyone?
There are a lot of people I think are candidates that we should give the needle to.
Yeah.
Oh. But I'm not so sure about the New York Times needle. Although, honestly, this may be a real change in the kind of media environment. I'm a New York Times subscriber. I generally like the New York Times outside of political news, which they do a pretty bad job on. But do you go there on election night? I don't go to the New York Times on election night typically.
You know, I don't know where I'm going on election night. I mean, that there are so many different places to go. In fact, that's one of the things I have to figure out today, what the strategy will be. Generally, I think that the best option is to go to people who are really knowledgeable, who really know how to read the results, and then follow them on Twitter. Yeah. Because the, you know, when a result comes in, you know this, saying, well, you know, X percent of the voter in Florida and so-and-so is leading, unless you know exactly where those votes are coming from, what county, what percentage of the votes from that county, what the expectations were for that county, what the targets were. The numbers are absolutely meaningless, but there are wonks out there and you can follow those wonks. I'm going to do a wonk search later this afternoon.
Yeah, that's good. I don't really do the Twitter thing. So, I will not be doing that, but maybe I'll, where will I check in? This is kind of my tradition. This is my 1 year of the night to watch television, at least watch cable news. I always tell people, even when I was in New York and I used to be on Fox News a lot, I've never watched a Fox News program all the way through. And I don't expect that I probably ever will.
I think they're going to be talking about the gypsy threat tonight.
Or, you know, I have some cousins in Eastern Europe, and they are just horrifying on the subject of gypsies. Gypsy prejudice is a real thing in the world, apparently, still, but it's a European thing.
Well, it's a big thing on Tucker Carlson, and you can always tell when things are getting a little bit difficult because he's going to shift to the gypsies. Okay, so before we get into the heavy duty punditry today, and how we feel about all of this, the president, who's been on this whirlwind tour, called into Fox News. He was here in my home state of Wisconsin, where he spent a great deal of time. He came into Kenosha last night. And as far as I can tell from social media, he spent most of the time complaining about the quality of his microphone and threatening not to pay the vendors because the microphone was so shitty. So, hey, so that's the way. And then he was also attacking Bon Jovi.
That, you know, every time he meets Bon Jovi. Microphone's a hard way to get a Reagan moment.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so he calls in to Fox and Friends this morning, which is his safe space, and I'll let people decide what how they think he sounds. Okay, so this is Election Day. This is the important day of his life. This is the day that will determine whether or not he is a one-term president. And here's President Donald Trump calling into Fox and Friends.
So, Mr. President, the analysis of what they're talking about and some of the things you've said, they are suggesting that you may declare victory if the early numbers favor you. At what point will you declare victory?
When there's victory, if there's victory, I think we'll have victory. I think the polls are, you know, suppression polls, and I think we'll have victory, but only when there's victory. I mean, you know, there's no reason to play games. And I think we'll have victory. I think we're, you know, I look at it as being a very, a very solid chance at winning. I don't know what the chances are. I don't know how they rate the chances, but I think we have a very solid chance of winning.
Kevin Williamson, low energy. I mean, really low energy.
Yeah, we know he doesn't drink, but that's kind of what I sound like when I've had about six. You know, it's funny that he was saying he doesn't know what the chances are, because I think he's got a hotel in Las Vegas. He's got to know some odds makers out there. You know, he knows the guy to make a phone call and talk to you about it. So, yeah, he's always been a strange cat. He's going to be a strange cat all night tonight. And I think that if he should lose, his lame duck period is going to be a real entertaining circus.
Ugly.
The fact that even some of his most sycophantic admirers are going to be happy to see him heading for the exits in the end of January.
Well, I don't think he's going anywhere, but you are right. I think there's a lot of people who will be really relieved, and of course that's going to be the fascinating, you know, question if he loses. I must admit I'm obsessed with the question is, will he show up on January 20th for the inauguration? What do you think? I actually was on a radio show and I hedged and fudged it, and I said 55-45 he'll show up. I think I'm wrong.
I wouldn't be surprised if either he or Biden decided not to do the touchy-feely post-election handshakes, we're all good buddies here thing. Biden's going to be under tremendous pressure not to do that.
They got the pandemic excuse. Hey, I would do this, but no.
Who knows where that guy's been?
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know where the guy's been. Yeah. You know what he's been doing. Yeah. But I'm trying to imagine. You know, actually, that is true. They're probably not going to do the whole thing. But it seems to me impossible to imagine Donald Trump sitting up there watching this massive crowd, which will be way bigger than his crowd, and they will be just loving the fact that they are celebrating his defeat. There's nothing in Donald Trump's makeup that will make him say, I should do this. This is a good thing for me to do. There's no way he's coming. No way.
And honestly, it might not even be safe for him to do so.
Well, that's also true. So look, I want to talk about your piece in National Review, which was Hell No. And right before we began this podcast, we were just chatting about your book that came out in 2015, The Case Against Trump. So, I mean,
not a bestseller, that book.
Well, it was in this household. I don't know if you remember when we met. We actually had dinner together in San Francisco. It was very weird. Okay, so this was at the National Review Institute or something,
and yeah,
this was in a different century, and I was the MC, and had your book come out yet at that point?
I don't recall.
Yeah, because I was very anxious for it. I was in the camp of, come on, man. Oh, you know, that was probably pretty late in 2016. So it had come out, but I remember really wanting it to come out. But I guess the point is that you have been at this for 5 freaking years.
Yeah.
5 years telling people who Donald Trump is, what Donald Trump means. And today is the day that may not be the end of the Trump era, because I don't think it will be. But it's the beginning of the end of the Trump presidency, I think. So yeah. 5 years. Can you imagine how much time we have spent over the last 5 years thinking about this guy, talking about this guy, writing about this guy?
Yeah, well, in fact, you know, it's funny because I'm actually not all that much of a Trumpologist. You know, I don't really write about the president all that much. I did write that little book about him back in 16, and I do occasionally feel obliged to check in on it, but I'm not really a write about the president guy. That's not my job. I'm more of a, you know, social issues and policy guy. And I think that you hit upon something that's going to be on my mind very much over the next few days, which is that irrespective of what happens with the election tonight, what Trump stands for is going to remain for some time and have to be confronted and understood and managed and dealt with in some way. And that is going to be a real long-term challenge, and it's going to make a lot of people not very happy. And there are a lot of, I think, expectations that certain frayed relationships within the conservative movement and the Republican Party will go away after this. And Trump is a uniquely bad specimen, but he's not really the fundamental problem. He's not really the issue. He's much more symptom than
cause. So what is the fundamental problem then?
Well, it's a couple of things. It's the increasingly tribalistic nature of American politics, which I also wrote a little book about called The Smallest Minority, and the transformation of the president and the presidency from an administrative officer into a kind of cultural totem and chieftain, so that anytime one tribe's guy is not in office and the other tribe's guy is, they have to feel excluded and humiliated and alienated from their own society. And they can't just say, well, we lost this election, but the government does what the government does and life goes on.
Yeah, right.
Everything becomes an existential confrontation. That's a big part of it. And that has to do with the fact that we've had changes to social and family and economic life related to what we call, for lack of a better term, globalization, that have left people looking for new sources of meaning and belonging, stability in their life. And they've turned to politics, and this particularly tribalistic form of partisan politics, yeah, as a substitute for things like religion and family and community. It's no longer, this is how I voted, but this is who I am. This is the sort, yeah, of person I am. And if that's the sort of person you are, you know, we can't have Thanksgiving dinner together. And I don't think that problem is going away on either side. There are particular things on the right that are problems that don't have exact parallels on the left. I mean, we really do have people on the right who just have basically fundamental disagreements about what to do about things like free trade and immigration, mm-hmm, sure, and things like that. And those are not issues that you can kind of half a loaf on very much. You know, one side is going to want to prevail in those. And when one of those sides does prevail, people for whom the other view of that issue is their make or break thing. And there are people like me who really do care a whole lot about trade and who really do care a whole lot about immigration policy. If they don't get their way, they're going to have very strong political incentives to go looking somewhere else. The other problem for the Republican Party, of course, and I wrote a piece about this in the Wall Street Journal this week, is that it is in decline in the parts of the country that are growing. In cities and suburbs, among the educated people, you know, where the people in the GDP and the college degrees are, the Republican Party is not doing so well, which is why I think Texas isn't play tonight. And I wouldn't be, I'd be surprised if Biden won Texas, but I wouldn't be shocked.
I almost put it the other way around. You're a Texas guy, so you know more about this. It would be existentially shocking in American politics if Joe Biden wins Texas tonight.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm just turning around because of what it represents. It is like the fast forward of all of the demographic issues. It's not surprising because, of course, the polls are dead, you know, are very, very tight. And there's this massive surge. So whether it's shocking or not. But yeah, so this is not going away. And I think people need to understand this, that the fever doesn't break, you know, simply because the tweets stop, and by the way, they're not going to stop. The Republican Party doesn't heal itself. So I want to talk about this, the last 5 years, though, because this morning, as I was thinking back on Election Day, I went back and found the transcript of my very last appearance on Fox News after I went on and said this, I was never invited back again and never will be. And this was May 2016, and everybody else was getting on board the Trump train, and I was asked by then host Megyn Kelly, long story there, why I wasn't getting on. And this is what I said. I said, Donald Trump is a serial liar, a con man who mocks the disabled and women. He's a narcissist and a bully, a man with no fixed principles who has the vocabulary of an emotionally insecure 9-year-old. So no, I don't want to give him control of the IRS, the FBI, and the nuclear codes. That's just me. And I haven't changed my mind about this guy. In fact, the last 5 years feels like it's just been a gloss on all of that. So Have you been surprised by this? The line that jumped out at me from your piece in National Review is the case against Trump is a lot like the case against Trump in 2016, but bolstered by the accumulation of evidence and experience.
Yeah. Well, before I respond to that, one point of contention, I think, which is that before I was an emotionally insecure 48-year-old, I once was an emotionally insecure 9-year-old. I think I had a better vocabulary. So let's not...
I apologize to 9-year-olds.
I'm on the toddler too hard there. Yeah, so in 2016, on election night and immediately thereafter, I had a couple of conversations with some senior Republican officials, as they call themselves. And... the general expectation was that, at some point when he gets inaugurated, Trump gets sat down and someone comes in, some, Al Haig type figure, and gives him the what's what. Here's what's actually going on in the world. Here's the actual dangers we face. Here are the problems domestically. Here are the problems internationally. Here are the things that are on your inbox, right now. And what are you going to do about it? And how can we help? And I kind of thought that even Donald Trump, silly character as he is, would at that point sort of sober up. He would go, well, hell, I never actually expected to win this stupid thing, but now I'm president of the United States. At the very least, I don't want to embarrass myself and go down in the history books as a ridiculous buffoon, which of course is what he's done instead. Maybe I should take this seriously. Maybe I should start consulting some people and listening to people who actually know about this stuff, delegate some things. And as I mentioned in the National Review piece, to the extent that he did that, those are the places where he was really quite successful.
Yeah, Federal Society judges.
Right, yeah, like punting that stuff over to people who knew what they were doing. And all he has to do is say, well, you did my homework for me. Thanks. I'm happy to take this list and do it. Because he's totally intellectually capable of trying to nominate Jeanine Pirro or Judge Judy or his sister or whoever to the Supreme Court. That's his sort of normal inclination. In fact, the first time he was asked about that, he suggested he would nominate his now estranged sister. So, the tax bill, which has some pretty good things in it, although I think it had some problems as well, was largely a Paul Ryan joint. And he has, in deregulation, things like that, more or less outsourced that stuff to responsible kind of conservative ink type figures. Although he hasn't always got that quite right either. And it's the stuff that he's actually interested in and gets personally involved in that are a mess. Foreign relations, immigration, those sorts of things. Trade especially, where he's just made a hash of things and cost Americans probably hundreds of billions of dollars that'll never be recovered. So, people, because of this tribalistic aspect of our politics, people really demand from me a lot, say you'll vote for him, say you like him better than Biden. Of course, I won't say those things, or at least admit that he's been good for African Americans, or at least admit this, or at least admit that. It's this very you shall admit confessional, inquisitional model of politics we're in right now. But my basic position here is that, I'm a conservative. I'm pretty naturally inclined to support Republicans and to give Republican candidates the benefit of the doubt. And to give them a bit of leeway for being politicians and that kind of stuff. We do that. That's natural. But if you want my vote or you want my support, you just can't ask me to vote for a corrupt buffoon who doesn't actually really agree with most of the things that I agree with, who can't do the job, who spent 4 years showing that he can't do the job and isn't willing to learn how to do the job and wasn't really even quite trying to do the job. So if that means Biden, well, that means Biden, although I've got high hopes for Joe Jorgensen of Libertyville, Illinois. How great is it that the Libertarian nominee was born in a city called Libertyville?
It's perfect.
That's foresight.
It's almost like Bill Clinton coming from Hope, right?
Yeah.
It was something like that. Well, you know, the pushback that you get the same pushback that I get, which is that, oh, you're just objecting to the aesthetics, that you're objecting to his personality. If it wasn't for the tweets, it wouldn't be so bad.
Yeah, that and elections are binary, the two great intellectually cowardly dodges of our time. When you're voting for someone, you're affirming that. You're affirming that position. You're saying, I select this person to be president of the United States of America. Now, you can tell yourself all day, well, I was making a lesser of two evils choice, and maybe you were. And as I've always said, I like Trump better than Hillary, or I like Trump better than Joe Biden, is a perfectly defensible position. It's not necessarily my position, but it's a perfectly respectable position. The non-respectable position is this guy's a good president. He's been good for the country. He's done great things for America. And this nonsense about he's worked harder than anyone else. He's the only man who's ever tried to keep his promises. And, you know, all of this nonsense.
Do people actually believe that? I'm actually serious, but I hear people say things like that, and I really want to look in their eyes and go, okay, is somebody at home there? Do you actually believe these things? Yeah, or do you think you have to say these things?
I spent a couple of weeks reading stuff on self-radicalization among Islamic militants and, you know, how these people who are the sons of dentists in relatively prosperous suburbs of Cairo managed to turn themselves into suicide bombers. And I think that it's a lot like what we've seen with the sort of, you know, self-radicalization of the Trump movement, which is not to say that I think these people are the moral equivalent of Al-Qaeda suicide bombers, but it is possible to work oneself up into a kind of frenzy without a lot of help from the outside. And they do have, of course, quite a bit of help from the outside, what we've come to call the entertainment wing of the conservative movement, the Hannitys and such of the world. And that is a growing baneful influence on our public discourse. But no, I think these people are sincere about it. You know, I was talking to someone yesterday, an older guy, but not a complete fool. And he is just convinced that Trump is going to win 48 or 49 states tonight. He's going to win California. And he's convinced of that, not because of anything he's read or any polls or things like that, but because it's an argument that makes sense to him moralistically. So he believes that Biden doesn't deserve to win these states, therefore Biden will not. And that kind of conflation of one's own moralistic preferences and social affiliations with reality, I think, really drives a lot of that stuff that you're asking.
Did you prepare him for disappointment?
I offered to bet him $20,000.
Yeah, there's money on the table out there. This would be a great moment. Just like, there's the pro tip: find people like this and see whether or not they're willing to put some money on it. No, it is interesting to me, and I do know what you're talking about, this alternative reality that if you're immersed in it, if you marinate in it long enough, you begin to believe it, or it becomes irrelevant whether it's true. It's what you. It's like what you swim in. You know what I'm saying? It's and that, because I hear people, I understand the people who will make the transactional arguments. It's the people who do the he was the hardest working man, or he is such a good man or character. Now listen, I don't want to get you in a fight with anybody, because you've had enough fights in your life, okay? But it's not just the entertainment wing. You know someone who we won't name them, because they're a publisher of a small publishing house that has published you. serious intellectual, I mean, serious thinker, who's actually
going to figure out you're talking about.
Okay, but who's actually written pieces saying that defending Donald Trump as a man of really good character.
Yeah,
I mean, it's one thing to say, I like the judges with the regulation, but how do you get to the point where you look at Donald Trump and say, this is a man of good character, a man of honesty and of probity and of discretion? How do you get there?
I don't know. You know, Roger is a dear friend, and
we're not naming any names. I'm not the guy that brought up Roger Kimball's name. I did not say Roger Kimball on this podcast.
Let's take this away from just being Roger.
That's all on you now, Kevin.
Happy to say that I just think he's wrong about this one. I disagree with him. Mm-hmm. And that I think it's a pretty tough case to make, and that he hasn't made it successfully. But in terms of your more kind of, you know, pointy-headed intellectual conservative types, I think that there's a natural tendency to be seduced by power. And so when someone wins election as president of the United States, they automatically get invested with this sort of awesome power that is really quite seductive. And people find excuses, and they come up with ever more unlikely arguments and justifications. And, you know, I want to sit them down for the, you know, Sunday school lesson, because they do think of this as a particularly Christian undertaking as well, and remind them of Isaiah and woe unto them who call evil good and justify wickedness for profit, which I think is a lot of what's going on with some of this in some corners. Some people, I think, are acting in perfectly good faith. They are grievously wrong, and they have sort of radicalized and worked themselves up into a position that I think they wouldn't have come to if they had taken a calmer and cooler approach. But some people are also just, trying to sell doggy vitamins.
Right. Well, that's true. But and we shouldn't underestimate the attraction of power. This is not a new phenomenon. I mean, in human history, there are a lot of throne sniffers, and there have been throne sniffers for 3,000 years. So this is not something that we just invented here. Or so to a certain extent, that would be the default setting. But you make an interesting point in your article. You say, look, the practical case against Trump is very simple. He stinks at his job.
Yeah.
And I noticed that Henry Olson, who's been kind of Trumpy, has a great analysis over at the Washington Post why Donald Trump is going to lose tonight. He says it's very common sense. He's failed at his major job. People look at him. He's faced his crisis of the coronavirus, and he blew it. And what's really extraordinary about that is, leaving aside all of the other stuff that you and I have written about him and we know about him, if he had gotten the coronavirus right, if he had been an effective, strong, credible leader, he'd probably be cruising to reelection. Because you look at other elected officials who face this, and they've benefited politically. You look at the prime minister of New Zealand. There's a lot of other examples. Governors around the country have their approval ratings have just spiked. Donald Trump is almost unique among world leaders and among political leaders in being destroyed by his own failure to take this seriously.
Yeah, I think that you're probably right about that. I think that one of the things I always try to address, and I've never been successful in doing this and probably never will, but we have a basically superstitious attitude about the relationship between the president and the economy. So we think if the economy is doing well, it's because the president's smart and good.
Right, right.
If the economy is doing poorly, it's because he's bad and dumb. And these things are not really related quite that directly. But given the state of the economy pre-epidemic, I think it's very likely that Trump would have been able to make a pretty persuasive case for himself and say, look, you may not like the tweets. Maybe you don't like the way I talk. Maybe you don't like this, that, or the other, but unemployment is here. This is what wage growth has done. This is what's happened for, wages, employment for African-Americans and for Hispanics and for immigrants. And, I've delivered results. Now, I think that argument would be bull for the most part, but it'd probably be persuasive bull. And, you live by the sword, you die by the sword. And we had a pretty serious economic collapse after that. People are not in very good shape right now, including a lot of people who would probably be naturally inclined to be Trump voters. And his general affect surrounding the response to the epidemic has been pretty troubling, I think, in terms of the dishonesty and the chaos and silliness and the obvious refusal to take it seriously, and spending the first part of the response basically treating it as a stock market problem and trying to tweet the markets up and that sort of thing. So, world leader, I think, has really got it entirely right. Although you've seen pretty good results in places like New Zealand and Taiwan. But, Angela Merkel did all the things I think you would expect someone in her position to do. And Germany still didn't really quite get it right. And, they're suffering second wave like a lot of Europe is right now. I think that if Trump had responded to this in a way that was serious and honest and responsible, even if it wasn't entirely successful, that seriousness and honesty and responsibility would have really redounded to his benefit politically. I don't think it's so much a case of, well, we didn't lick this virus and get it under containment, and we didn't do 25 things that nobody maybe could have thought to do back in January. But it's more, I think, the impression that he's just not taking it seriously, that he views it as an inconvenience for himself.
Well, and also he was able, Andrew Cuomo, I think, did a terrible job in New York, and yet he was at least able to portray himself as caring.
Yeah.
So something else you said before, when it came to judges, Trump outsourced it to the Federalist Society. It basically became, play and plug, right? Plug and play. You just, they gave him a list. He put the list in. Everybody says, that's actually pretty good. Imagine if he would have done the same thing with the coronavirus. In other words, just said, I trust the Federalist Society when it comes to judiciary. I'm going to trust this group of scientists and epidemiologists on this. We have a very, very different political environment right now. We also probably have a rather dramatically different death count. Now, I would not have voted for Donald Trump. I think the case against Donald Trump is overwhelming besides that. But it's hard not to think that he would be in a very different political position if he had treated the virus the way he treated the judiciary.
Yeah, I think that if he had sort of got out of the way, you know, I mean, for a while when he was, you know, trying to run the briefings himself and all that, which turned out to be a catastrophe, if he could have sort of stepped aside and done what you said, well, then we would have spent the last several months with effectively the face of the Trump administration being Fauci and the CDC and various scientists, things like that, which I suspect would have had a reassuring effect on people and also would have just by, you know, the communicative property, invested the Trump administration with more of a sense of responsibility and seriousness and moral probity and intellectual probity than it has had. Instead, you know, he's going into this election as essentially an unlucky and less successful version of Silvio Berlusconi. But, you know, Berlusconi was running Italy, which isn't a real country. Yeah. Right. It's a tourist destination. I love Italy. Don't get me wrong.
Right.
You know, Italy can have a Silvio Berlusconi. I love Silvio Berlusconi when he was in office. He was endlessly entertaining. The United States of America can't be run by Silvio Berlusconi, much less a second-rate Silvio Berlusconi imitator.
Yeah, Silvio Berlusconi is entertaining unless he has nuclear weapons, right?
Yeah.
So in terms of this, I never thought I would say these words, but I'm kind of missing Steve Bannon because one of the differences between 2016 and 2020 is that back in 2016, there was at least somebody in the room who was able to tell Donald Trump how to make a closing argument, right? How to stay on the script. This is what you're talking about. The last day before the election, you're not threatening to stiff, you know, the sound technician. Maybe you ought to talk about the Supreme Court a little bit more as opposed to this very weird final tour that's left him exhausted. And of course, then we have this election eve stunner where, and I don't know how you feel about people who are the sort of the Vichy members of the administration, but, you know, Deborah Birx has been the one who, you know, hung on the longest, you know, even Anthony Fauci. At some point, the Faucian bargain, you know, wore out and he was exiled, but she was there, you know, going on Fox and saying, you know, that nobody knows the science better than Donald Trump and everything. Well, now we're finding out that she's sent out a memo, you know, bluntly contradicting the president on just about everything, on the threat, urging an all-out response, warning against the rallies. And, you know, good for her finally doing it. But, wow, it seems late. Where were you? We find this out the night before the election. Thank you, Deborah Birx. But I mean, if this guy gets elected, what's he going to do? Is he going to throw out all the scientists? Is he going to fire Fauci? Is he going to fire Birx? Are we going to sit around with that, complete crackpot Scott Atlas? Is that our destiny?
Maybe Peter Navarro.
Oh, yeah. Well, this, okay, by the way, we're talking about
the rest of these people. I think one of the things to always keep in mind is that the United States of America is a country with very low personal savings rate. And these people are going to be looking for jobs. And I think that what we're seeing right now is people deciding that there's not going to be jobs in the Trump administration to be had because there isn't going to be a Trump administration. And they are trying to get some professional distance and get some of that stink off themselves.
Yeah, it's a little bit late to get the stink off yourself if you waited until the day before the election. I mean, there are a lot of ways of getting the stink off yourself, but there are going to be a lot of people who I think it's going to dawn on them that having anything involving the Trump administration on their resume is not necessarily a good deal. So I want to actually go back to this whole question of, you know, Trump being a man of good character and everything. The phenomenon of Christians talking themselves into thinking that what he was Cyrus or King David and he was God's instrument. And even though he pays off porn stars, you know, he's going to be the vessel to restore, you know, Christian America and all that stuff. Okay. So leave that aside. It's also interesting to me that there's an entire group of people who feel that Donald Trump's fundamental amorality provides them cover, that it's moved the window of what constitutes a scandal. Do you know where I'm going on this? That his attraction to people who are all the other people who out there who are the grifters and the, you know, the sketchy, you know, folks who somehow think that they can be under his umbrella, where their conduct, which would earn them exile any place else, is suddenly acceptable. And I'm thinking in the back of my mind, just going here, I read this long Politico magazine article about Jerry Falwell Jr. and his wife. Have you seen this yet?
Here. No, I haven't looked at it.
Oh man, it's just like pour yourself a bourbon and read this thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, you want to talk about, I mean, you know, come for the, you know, three-way sex and stay for the absolute self-dealing nepotism and grifting. And as you put it down, you go, okay, I get it now. I get why a thorough creep and crook like Jerry Falwell Jr. would think that Donald Trump's great, that I'm going to associate himself with him. I'm going to pal around with someone like this, because maybe for them, it's sort of the opposite of the stink wearing off. It's that the stink is so great that nobody's going to notice how badly they stink.
Yeah, I think that with the caveat here, of course, that Sigmund Freud was a intellectual fraud. Well, he was. He was a bad scientist. He was a poor scientist, as Dr. Ghostbuster would say. But the concept of projection, I think, is actually kind of useful, because my observation is, in fact, that people tend to generalize from their own characters. So people who are dishonest expect everyone to be dishonest. Men who are unfaithful to their wives tend to be very, very jealous and assume that their wives are going to be unfaithful to them. People who cheat and chisel and lie in business expect that everyone else does. And partly that's in order to offer themselves justification. Well, everyone else is doing it. I have to level the playing field for myself. We can't be gentlemen losers like Mitt Romney. But part of it is people actually really believe that. And dishonest people believe that other people are like them. And I suspect that Falwell and people like that really believe that they live in a world that is populated largely by people like themselves. Instead of the truth, which is they live in a world that's populated about, you know, 25% by people like themselves, which is not a huge number, but it's not nothing either. One of my great regrets, by the way, of my most recent book, In the Smallest Minority, is that the one line Regnery made me take out was a great line about Jerry Falwell Jr., which I unfortunately cannot repeat here, but I'll tell you about some other time.
Oh, well, you can repeat it here.
No. Well,
you think we're not going to get an explicit rating? We get an explicit rating all the time. Okay, I won't push you to this. So, and we talked about The Smallest Minority. You've been on the podcast to discuss that book as well, because, you know, we are living in, I mean, I do think that one of the big challenges that we're going to face is not right versus left, but liberalism, small L, versus illiberalism.
Yeah.
And the challenge against liberal democracy does not come exclusively from the left. And I think this is one of the things that right now people on the left don't want to hear this. They don't want to hear a both sides-ism. But once this is all over, I think we're going to have to confront the illiberalism across the political spectrum, which of course was what you have been writing about.
Yeah. And of course that illiberalism doesn't only come from the state as well. You know, it's a matter of employment life, and, you know, particularly in big corporations like, you know, Google and Microsoft and JP Morgan and places like that take a really aggressive kind of political stance toward their employees and toward other things as well. So I think that, yeah, you're probably right about that. But I think that is a conflict that happens mainly in the culture, not mainly in politics. Mm-hmm. I think this is definitely a case of where society is heading is going to influence government a lot more than government going to influence where society is heading.
Fair point. No, fair point. Okay, so it is election day. Mm. People are going to be listening to this, and it's going to be on our permanent record. So if we're completely wrong, and I think that Donald Trump is going to be defeated for re-election, I don't think it's going to be particularly close. I think there are going to be some states that are going to be nail-biters. But do you want to talk about Texas? What do you think is going to happen in Texas down there? Because to me, as this has gone on, I've become more and more fascinated by the incredible votes in Texas, what's happening in Texas, the desperate legal maneuver down there to throw out 127,000 votes out of Democratic-leaning Harris County. But I also kind of feel that it's been the Lucy and the football, you know, the whole Beto O'Rourke thing, you know, the, you know, Beto. And, he comes within 3 points, but he comes in with 3 points against one of the most detested figures in American politics, Ted Cruz. But so tell me what your gut sense tells you about Texas right now.
Yeah, well, if I were betting my own money on it, I would bet that Trump wins Texas. But it'll be closer than people want for it to be. Republicans in Texas are having a little bit of a come to Jesus moment, I think, right now. And I think what really got their attention was that last time around, in 2018, there were a number of Republican candidates who lost races in this state and lost races while they still had money in the bank.
Yeah.
So the Republican Party here had grown very complacent, very self-satisfied. It has been for a long time, to a non-trivial extent, corrupt. And these things are all kind of coming home to roost. But the, you know, the principal problem isn't, you know, people moving here from other states. In fact, there's been some reason to believe that the migration from California and such has been a net positive for Republicans in Texas, because the people leaving California tend to be more conservative. The problem is that growing Hispanic population. Trump may actually do relatively well among Hispanics in Texas. The Mexican-American population in Texas is distinct. It's socially and culturally quite different from, say, California. But the problem, of course, is cities and suburbs. You know, Texas has six of the nation's 25 biggest cities in it. It's got, I guess, two of the six largest metropolitan areas in it. It's an increasingly urban state, and the suburbs, particularly in places like Harris County and Dallas County, Tarrant County, increasingly resemble the cities that they surround. You're seeing, you know, essentially the Philadelphia pattern happening in Texas cities, where for a long time, those five counties were, you know, Philadelphia had Democratic turnout of about 117% on any given election.
Yeah.
And then the other four, you know, suburban counties were pretty reliably Republican. Then, you know, Montgomery County went Democratic, then Delaware County went Democratic, and then Bucks County went Democratic. And, you know, eventually you lose the whole region. And I think we're seeing that around here too, where, you know, Dallas County has been pretty overwhelmingly Democratic for a long time. But now you're seeing it in Tarrant County, where Fort Worth is. And, you know, you're seeing Democratic inroads in traditionally more conservative places like Collin County and Williamson County, no relation. And these trends are very, should be very worrying for Republicans this year, certainly, but also in the long term. So, you know, Trump won Texas with 52% of the vote in 2016. Not a huge number. So he far outperformed in the neighboring states, in Oklahoma, in Arkansas, in Louisiana. I think in Oklahoma he got 65%, something like that. And then, you know, in Wyoming he was at almost 70% of the vote, I want to say, something like that. So his performance in Texas wasn't very good to start with, and he underperformed the Republican House candidates in that same year by about five or six points, I think maybe five, now that I think about it. So he's not been a super strong candidate here in the past. So when we've got polling that shows them tied, as some highly regarded polls do, or polls that show Trump at a lead of less than 2%, I still would be surprised if he lost Texas this year, but I wouldn't be just shocked by it. Although I agree that this would be a real wake-up call, I think, for conservatives and for the Republican Party. Although what they should be paying attention to is the fact that Democrats may win a majority in the Texas State House.
I was actually going to mention that, because the down ballot implication, even if Trump wins Texas, you have a bunch of Republican congressional seats that are vulnerable in the areas you just described. And then, of course, there's the possibility of the Democrats taking control of the legislature, the House. So there are a lot of long-term consequences to what's going to happen today in Texas.
Yeah, and I think it's a real sign of our times that you've got Republicans in Texas saying to themselves, well, thank God we don't have straight ticket voting.
Yeah, I bet they do. I'm trying to think whether we still have straight ticket voting. People don't. In Wisconsin, we had a long tradition of splitting our votes. It was kind of a thing. And then starting about 2010, that went away. It appeared to, you know, it was, you know, total partisan voting. I think it came back in 2018, but it's going to be very interesting to see how that plays out again. No, Texas has become this fascinating, this fascinating story, because you get the sense that the future of the Electoral College and of national politics is going to be playing out in the Sun Belt right now. As much as I think the focus of the election needs to be on the upper Midwest. I mean, I think whatever happens, it's going, the election tonight will be decided by Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin. He holds that blue wall. And if Biden holds that blue wall, he can lose Texas. He can lose Florida. He can lose North Carolina. I think he can even lose Arizona. Mm-hmm. I have my map in front of me. But as long as he wins Pennsylvania and Michigan and Wisconsin, it becomes very, very, very difficult for Donald Trump to get to 270. So I'm a big believer in the blue wall, but I am absolutely fascinated by watching these numbers out of Texas and who these people are that are coming out and the numbers and the enthusiasm. It strikes me as really ironic that in the year in which the Republican Party becomes overtly and obviously the party of voter suppression and doing everything possible to make it harder to vote and harder to count votes, that you're having this voter backlash that's going to be, it's going to be something for historians to look at for a very long time.
Yeah. And I also think that, and this may be short-lived, I'm not sure, but it's really difficult, I think, for Republicans to make the, blue state model doesn't work argument in Texas, because you've got, my alma mater, the University of Texas, in a very, very liberal city and a very liberal county, which is governed as though it were a county in California. And it's putting out tens of thousands of graduates every year who are staying in Austin and getting good jobs and living good lives and perfectly happy with their situation. So to tell some guy who just finished up at UT and went to work for Apple and is making $180,000 a year, you've got no future. He's not buying that. He feels like he's got a pretty good future. And if you have Democrats governing you, you're going to be, poor and have no job. He's saying, I've got Democrats governing me now, and I'm doing fine. And so, in a sense, Texas Republicans can be partly a victim of the state's success, because people are doing pretty well in Houston, San Antonio, Dallas, Fort Worth. When Cruz lost Fort Worth to Beto, that left my hometown of Lubbock as the largest reliably Republican city in Texas.
Lubbock. Yeah. Really? Well, we're going to find out a lot. Think how much smarter we're going to be 24 hours from now. And of course, I'm waiting for all the pundits to explain, well, of course, this was what was going to happen. So Kevin Williamson, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. I appreciate it very much. Kevin's piece in National Review, Hell No, The Case Against Trump in 2020 is a lot like the case against Trump in 2016, but bolstered by the accumulation of evidence and experience. It is, as usual, Kevin, a great take.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Good talking to you.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. This is Election Day 2020, and we will be back tomorrow to talk about what the hell just happened. Okay.